This is a conversation with Bianca Tylik of Worth Rises on the NBA, Black Lives Matter, and the problematic carceral capitalism of Detroit Pistons owner Tom Gores. We'll be discussing why Bianca's organization, Worth Rises, has engaged in a campaign of activism against Detroit Pistons owner Tom Gores, how Tom Gores has made money off the suffering of Black, brown, and poor people, and how Detroit Pistons and other NBA players can join both in this fight and a larger fight about questions of NBA ownership, racial capitalism, and making Black Lives Matter in America. For more conversations like this, you can go to our back catalog on the Arts of Travel podcast on Apple, Google, Spotify, and other platforms. I highly recommend our conversation with attorney and activist Alec Karakatsanis on criminal justice reform. And you can go to our website, asiaarttours.com. We host print interviews on a variety of subjects, including capitalism, Black Lives Matter, and social justice globally. Here's my conversation now with Bianca Tylik of Worth Rises. I hope you enjoy our conversation today.
Hi, my name is Bianca Tylik, and I'm the executive director of Worth Rises. We're an organization dedicated to dismantling the prison industry and ending the exploitation of those it targets. When we think about the industry, we think about corporations and their government partners that are using the criminal legal system to exploit and extract wealth out of Black, brown, indigenous communities that are disproportionately represented in the criminal legal system or in mass incarceration because of racist policies and policing. And we believe that no entity or individual should depend on human caging or control for their wealth, operation, or livelihood.
In researching our conversation, I went through a report from the Harvard Crimson, and it talks about sort of the fight at Harvard over its $40 billion endowment and how that intersects with policing and prisons. This is a quote. Companies on their list range from Amazon, which they say provides facial recognition and other information technology to ICE to track immigrants, to a number of banks, including Bank of America and Wells Fargo, which they say finance the debts of CoreCivic and Geo Group. They also list the Bank of America and Goldman Sachs for their role in financing police brutality bonds. So within that small sentence, there's a lot of information. I've heard about groups like CoreCivic and Geo Group and their spike stocking when Trump was actually initially elected. That was a very interesting quirk of the stock market. But I had never actually heard of police brutality bonds. And I'm wondering, and you don't need to be exhaustive, because I think it would be just a 45 minutes to answer this one question. But could you give us a snapshot of some of the ways these more abstract financial actors, like of Bank of America and Goldman Sachs, are actually directly implicated in some of the conversations, the hard conversations we're having in America about police brutality, the carceral system, and white supremacy, if that also is part of this larger critique?
Yes, that's a great question. And I'll use three examples. So I think police brutality bonds is one example, and ACRE, the Action Center on Race and the Economy, has done a ton of work on police brutality bonds, and people should refer to their work on this issue. But essentially, what these are is when there is a settlement, when a cop murders somebody or abuses somebody, causes harm, and a lawsuit comes to, let's say, a local municipality, a city, a county, whoever it might be, there are lawsuits and there are often settlements. And rarely do we actually talk about those settlements and how much money municipalities spend paying out settlements for the abuse of residents by police officers, but that is a big line item that often happens in many places. And because that line item is so large in the budget, it's often not one that can be immediately paid out by those municipalities because they can't afford to. And yet they have to, because that is the requirement of the settlements. And so what will happen is they will issue municipal bonds to pay out that settlement, and then taxpayers are essentially paying those bonds back. But in order, or paying those, you know, bonds to the maturity, and there are people who own and hold those bonds. But bonds, just like in any other area, have to be underwritten, which means there has to be someone who puts, you know, down the money in the first place, you know, moves that through the market. And so that's the role that some of these banks are playing that you mentioned, Bank of America and Goldman and others, is that they're underwriting these bonds that are used to pay the settlements for abuse and brutality at the hands of the police. And those are, as I said, really in large part then financed by taxpayers and other residents, and often sort of go unmentioned. But I think there's other examples, right? The private equity field, if we think about that, it's an area, again, a bit more obscure than sort of the average person would be comfortable with. Private equity, you know, I sort of describe as, I think private equity does to companies what a contractor does when he flips a house, right? He might buy a house and fix it up, maybe do an addition to the house, and after a little bit of time of TLC, will sell it, right, for hopefully a handsome profit after what's been invested. Well, private equity firms do something similar, but to companies. They buy companies and essentially in many cases restructure them, change sort of clean up or make more efficient, as they would say, their business models. Often requires firing a lot of people. Might do some roll-on acquisitions, buying some, you know, smaller market players, typically hold them for about 3-4 years before they sell them. And so, and they have a tremendous amount of capital to do so, especially because they usually buy these companies and are highly levered, meaning they borrow a lot of debt to acquire these companies before they sell them off again. So it doesn't cost them a whole lot, right? It's kind of like putting a down payment at 20% or 40%. And so that's, you know, how they function. And when they do that, it allows for these predatory companies to have a lot more resources at their behest. And it's these private equity firms that in many cases have created monopolies and duopolies in the various sectors of the prison industry. So for example, in telecom, today, three companies make up 90% of the prison telecom market, and all three of them are owned by private equity firms. And they've been building those companies over the years, quietly and consistently purchasing others in the field. So you have these private equity firms, which are like also really big finance shops and firms that are invested in by endowments, by pensions, by insurance, by all these various types of big institutional investors. But as I mentioned, they also buy these companies using a lot of debt. So this brings that question up: who's financing this debt yet again? And again, it takes you back to the big banks, right? Deutsche Bank and others that are financing these the acquisitions of these companies that private equity firms are doing. So there's really a deep bench of financial actors that are involved in really the trading in many ways, and the bolstering and the capitalizing and the growth and expansion of the prison industry.
So the fight that we're going to center for our conversation today is the one that Worth Rises has been trying very diligently and very successfully against Tom Gores, who is the owner of the Detroit Pistons. And that's not why you're fighting with him. the crux of this battle is over the prison telecom company Securus, which is folded into a larger portfolio of companies that Tom Gores and his partners own. The NBA is full of a lot of capitalists, some more heinous than others. Donald Sterling's no longer in the league, but that doesn't mean that everything is right, and we'll touch upon that. But for Tom Gore specifically, could you highlight what it is about Securus's business model that you have found so offensive, noxious, and against the spirit of an NBA that wants to say Black Lives Matter as one of its centering mottos? What is it about Securus that has spurred this fight and this call to action from Worth Rises?
Tom Gores, as you noted, he is the founder and owner right now of, and CEO, I should say, of Platinum Equity. Platinum Equity is a private equity firm that, as I mentioned, now owns Securus. Securus is a predatory prison telecom company. They purchased Securus in 2017 for $1.6 billion. And Securus is the company that essentially many families have to rely on in order to communicate with their loved ones inside. Securus owns about 40% of the prison telecom market, and they can charge as much as a dollar a minute for people to be in touch with their loved ones inside. And so their business model is one that really is just meant to extract as much as possible from incarcerated people and their families. And I want to be clear, majority of people who are paying for phone calls are families. They are the ones who have the accounts. And it is often, you know, mothers, daughters, sisters, aunts, grandmothers that are paying these rates. And I think to really hit on the head, the impact that the predatory practices of this company has had. I'll give you just a few stats, or really one I think is just the most telling. One in three families with an incarcerated loved one goes into debt trying to stay in touch. 87% of those are women, and the large proportion of those are women of color. And so this issue is, you know, a criminal justice issue, but it's a racial justice issue. It's a gender justice issue. It's an economic justice issue. And that's how, you know, we want to think about it and understand that impact. And so this sort of wild exploitation, which isn't limited to just phone calls, because that's, you know, where the bread and butter of the business, but there's also, they've, you know, started introducing video callings and tablets and all these things, which, you know, I think have an aura of positivity in terms of increasing communication, but at rates that, you know, we could never imagine on the outside, and we would certainly never pay with the market that we have. And part of the reason that the rates are as high as they are is because Securus and others in the field offer governments a cut. So when they contract with a jail or a prison, they will often offer that that institution a percentage of the revenues that they earn. Now, the reason for that is it obviously incentivizes them to sign contracts with the company. And so the various companies in the field compete with who, based on who can actually provide, often the jails, these sheriffs or others, the most money. But one of the things that I think we need to stress as we talk about the current moment in American history is that Tom Gores is funding the police. It's not just that he's extracting a tremendous amount of wealth, $700 million a year, from communities, largely and disproportionately Black and Brown, but he's then funneling a large percentage of that money back into law enforcement to support that racist policing and policies that land people in many cases in prisons and jails in the first place. So I think that's a really key point that I want to stress more and more, that I think fewer people are really catching on to, or Yeah, or just thinking about. And then the second thing that I want to say is that it's actually also not even just about the money, which on alone would be the end of this discussion and really is enough. But on top of that, there are all these other practices that the company engages in that are harmful to communities, from, recording and handing over of phone calls while people are still awaiting trial to prosecutors, and not just phone calls with family members, but they have been routinely sued for breaches into handing over recorded privileged conversations with attorneys. They have an electronic monitoring company, so they put people on electronic monitors that they have to pay for. They have been sued, actually just this past year, were sued for price fixing within the industry with their competitors. They are building right now voice print databases. So these are databases of people's voices who are incarcerated. And in some cases, in some states, New York being one of them, they are refusing to allow people to use the phone if they don't give them a voice print. And with those voice prints, while they claim it's for security and all these things, what they're often doing and what their business plan and documents that we've reviewed have revealed is that they are packaging those voices into databases that they are then selling to law enforcement. So Securus is an arm at the end of the day of the law enforcement body. And so, and they're developing tools that yet have been questioned in many ways, their efficacy and their accuracy, but are nevertheless really enabling all of the things that we in this country, and I think in particular NBA players that were speaking out this summer, are most concerned about with regard to policing in America.
Jeremy Grant is a very interesting figure for the Detroit Pistons. He looks to be the future star of the team. And in a recent piece in The Athletic with James Edwards III, he was quite explicit that one of the reasons, or perhaps the main reason, he came to the Pistons was as a black man, that he viewed being signed by a black GM, Troy Weaver, and working with a highly respected coach who's black, Dwayne Casey. He saw in line with the Black Lives Matter movement and black empowerment. And for players like Jeremy Grant, how do you see your mission as aligned with his? And are there ways where you can work together with a player like Jeremy while still opposing the owner who pays his checks?
Yeah, it's such a complicated issue. So I want to say that we really respect the rationale, the reasoning, and all of that that Jeremy made to move to the Pistons. And I think, in reading that article, it wasn't just the GM and the coach, but it was also the city. Detroit is the city with the largest proportion of Black residents in the country. And I think he made some comments about wanting to play in a Black city, and I think that's really honorable and powerful, especially in this moment. I think it's regretful that all of that, right, is the Tom Gores can cast shade down on all of that, right? That he owns the team in that city, and that he himself, continues to build his wealth and the wealth of his friends and others who are in his fund, his investors, off of the struggles of a racist, criminal legal system. And I don't think that's even remotely questionable at this time, right? Where we understand the disproportionate impact it has had and why. I think we're eager to work with players like Jeremy because we know that we do have a shared vision, mission, a shared interest in seeing the best for Detroit and seeing the best for Black communities, not just in Detroit, but across the country. And it's challenging when you think about the owner, right? Because the owner has his own power as the person, as you said, that cuts the checks. And so, you know, we understand that that might put Jeremy in a difficult position, and, you know, and are thinking about ways in which we're having a lot of conversations. We can, you know, provide support to players who may want to speak out, or, you know, leverage other other resources and other folks who have a strong voice in that community, you know, to do the same and to provide that backing, because it's not easy.
I've been really disappointed with a lot of the coverage on the NBA and Black Lives Matter. Kyrie Irving comes to mind as well. His mother is a member of the Standing Rock Sioux, and in games this season, Kyrie took to burning sage, which is a traditional practice of some tribes in North America known as smudging. And this was reported by many outlets that I would normally respect for their NBA coverage as just sort of lunacy, or, you know, oh, Kyrie's being Kyrie. And I do think these sorts of conversations are unfortunately going to have to happen again, because I don't think the message is getting through that that Black Lives Matter, with these sort of contradictions of a figure like a Tom Gores, with what's happened in the Capitol on January 6th. I'm of the opinion, I want to ask this question to you, because you're leading of what seems to be a very brave campaign in taking on an extremely powerful person. I'm of the opinion these people can't be shamed. Or the people investing in their funds. The NBA strike, again, to return to it, was a very interesting potential what-if in NBA history, particularly as the union is headed by, from my understanding, a very brilliant attorney in Michelle Roberts, who I'm sure is explicitly aware of how to leverage the power of the workers of the NBA, its players. So I wanted to ask your thoughts on, if the message has gotten through, when we're still seeing that Black Lives Matter, if we're still seeing players like Kyrie mocked, and if sort of words are not going to be enough, where do you see potentially this campaign and maybe other campaigns working together to make sure that the message Black Lives Matter has an impact? Are we going to see new tactics from you and other individuals who want to bring attention and change to these violent practices of an owner like a Tom Gores?
Yeah, that's so powerful and so brilliantly, I think, put in question. So thank you. I think there's so many thoughts running through my mind, and I think the first of which I'll just say, it's a practice, it's a journey. You know, Black Lives Matter is not necessarily a destination, and although it's clear in what it's supposed to invoke, but I think, you know, for hundreds of years, this society has felt generally otherwise, and I don't think one summer is going to change that, right? The uprisings, you know, that happened like decades ago around racial, you know, and police brutality and Rodney King and like others you just think about are, you know, had their moment, and then we're still having this fight, right? So I think the reality is that, you know, there's no way we can assume that everyone's arrived where they need to be, and continuing, you know, to learn from there. The reality is many people haven't even gotten to whatever threshold that we're expecting them to at least understand. And I would say that's, you know, not just maybe folks in the NBA or otherwise, but, you know, it's media, as you're saying, right? Like, there's many people in the media that are yet figuring out what everything actually means. I think, you know, there's beyond that, I would say, like, are there people with decent intentions? Perhaps. Are there people with that can be motivated more so, right? And, you know, you mentioned, like, does shaming really work? You know, I think some people care about their public image, others don't. So it really depends. Some folks have a tremendous amount of resources to pour into, you know, PR and crisis management to try to rescue their brands. You know, our memory is short, so we're upset for a few you know, weeks or months in the media, and then it kind of dissipates. So some people will just hold on and keep moving. But I do think that what we focus on is less actually about just, are you shamed into particular behavior? But instead, how does that impact your bottom line? Because that's what people care about. And shaming is part of that. And what I mean by that is headlines matter. New investors don't want to be part of your awful headlines. And so actually in late 2019, we were able to get a major pension in Pennsylvania to not invest with Platinum Equity based on its investment in Securus, because it did not want to be a part of that. It said, no, absolutely not. There are headlines, and you know, and the chair of the investment committee was on the record saying there are headlines all over the country, from the New York Times to the LA Times to Philly Inquirer and more, about, you know, what's going on, and we don't want any part of this. So whether or not, and the way that they would have framed it is that it was an investment risk. And so there's a lot of different ways to frame it. And, you know, we get to the point where we're like, whatever your reason, let's, you know, articulate that and make it clear this is not okay. And so, so I think, you know, the MBA is reckoning with this because of the impact that it may potentially have, right? That's the concern. And I think the other thing is, as you said, institutions like the MBA and others are rife with folks who have made a lot of money, and it's hard to make that much money without there being skeletons in your closet. And so now, you know, they have one among them that's been exposed, and they're nervous. They're thinking about how to respond. If it's him today, is it going to be me tomorrow, right? What does that mean? What are we saying to the world? Are we admitting something, this, that, and the other? And I think it's going to be the challenge posed to the MBA. I mean, it is the challenge posed to the MBA. Will you put every, you know, dollar behind you into standing for what you say you stand for? And, you know, we don't view the MBA as, you know, a target in the sense that we are, you know, meant to shame the MBA. I think we are hoping that the MBA will do the right thing and, you know, align themselves with the truth and families who are struggling, and push Tom either out or to change, or to divest from Securus, I should say. And so hopefully they'll be a conduit, hopefully they'll be a partner. But if they choose to, you know, align with Tom, then they'll be on that side of things, and we'll be have to act accordingly. So, you know, I think that that narrative's still out. We're still not sure how things are going to play out. But of course, you know, this fight is around at least like his ownership of the Detroit Pistons is right at the start. We, you know, were successful in getting him removed from the LACMA board, which is the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. He was removed from that board after us raising these concerns within just 29 days. Which is remarkably fast. And it's worth noting that some of the members on the LACMA board are also on the MBA Board of Governors. So, you know, the fight's not new to them. And they made a particular decision for the LACMA, and we'll sort of see how, you know, they show up now as we start talking about the MBA.
The Ringer actually did a very interesting report on sort of racism and capitalism in the NBA. They can't frame it that explicitly because I think their branding is sort of the MJ quote of Republicans buy sneakers too, but it was as political as The Ringer gets. It was written, I believe, by John Gonzalez, and he basically went around and talked to several prominent figures, including one of the more outspoken coaches, the Warriors coach Steve Kerr. And it was very illuminating, and I wanted to quote a short passage and then ask a brief question as we move to sort of the tail end, maybe just two more after this. Warriors coach Steve Kerr said there's an understanding among players and coaches that most owners are very conservative. That generally wasn't a problem in the past, but he thought maybe it will become one. Kerr said Trump is different, that everything is out the window with him, decorum, class, dignity. All of that means there's a bigger and bigger divide. Like Cuban, Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, he thought it was fair to press Colangelo and the owners on their political contributions. Besides, Kerr said these days, there's very little that remains hidden. So for Worth Rises, something I'm very curious about is sort of where does this definition of violence and racism stop? In this report, they outline, and I believe there's actually even a very nice graph that looks at political contributions NBA owners have made. As someone who's lived near Detroit, I'm familiar with Dan Gilbert and some of the shady ways he's made money through real estate. When I think of NBA arenas, redlining comes to mind for me, how a lot of neighborhoods are sort of redeveloped and reshaped, for a majority black league, most black citizens of those cities could never afford these redeveloped areas. So you had mentioned sort of racialized capitalism at the start of our conversation. For Worth Rises, how is this more than an issue of just one bad owner and part of larger systemic critiques that you're hoping to build for NBA ownership as a whole?
So I think you raised so many really good examples, and something that just popped into my mind as you were talking is Stephen Ross. Stephen Ross is the owner of the Miami Dolphins in the NFL, right? The NFL team. And he has a foundation called Rise to Win. And Rise to Win is this foundation that has espoused many of the same values around BLM and racial justice and all of this. And in fact, actually does a lot of the diversity, equity, and inclusion training for leagues and teams across the country, not just in the NFL, but in the NBA, and the MLB, and in basically just about every sport, a lot of them turn to Rise to Win to do that type of diversity training, which is ironic because Stephen Ross also held fundraisers for Trump, who founded and funds this association. And he's made statements that he's not necessarily like a Trump supporter, which who knows, we don't know how he votes at the ballot box, but I don't care, right? At the bottom line is you're funding this man who welcome and understand does what he does because, as Stephen Ross has said, it's business. And so that is going back to this notion of like racialized capitalism, right? It's like, as long as we say it's business, it's justifiable in capitalism, no matter what the consequences of that business are. That's detrimental. So when you think that all of these teams, as they're challenged to be better on all these issues, are getting training from an institution, funded and created by this person, it blows your mind. You're like, well, then what's left, right? Like, we can't be training people with these type of values. And so, yeah, I think from the same, from everything that you mentioned, I do want to say that for us at Worth Rises, we are one piece of the puzzle, right? There is a powerful movement out there, our comrades, our colleagues out in the field that are doing a litany of really important work in racial justice. And we are really specifically focused, right, on the prison industry, on those corporations that build wealth off of incarcerated people and their loved ones. And we think it's, in many ways, one of the most egregious, obvious, and direct examples of everything we've been talking about. I think that policies are awful in many, many cases, but Tom's literally going into people's pockets and taking money out. I think there's systemic aspects, there's acute aspects and all of that. And right now, you know, I think the focus is on stopping Tom.
So Steven Jackson and I believe several other former NBA players were quite involved in Black Lives Matter protests. Something that I always worry about, and there's a litany of critiques and thoughtful dialogues about nonprofits or sort of organizational leadership, is I always wonder if change can happen coming from the top rather coming from the bottom. I was really moved by the Black Lives Matter protests for obvious reasons, but for organizationally, what I was very interested in is to see Black individuals with a lot of power and prestige walking with sort of ordinary people who do not have those resources, do not have that fame, do not have that privilege. And I'm wondering, for an organization like Worth Rises, which is headed by you as the founder, how do you see yourself in conversation with some of these more mass movements and this idea of, do you want to be sort of leading this fight, or do you envision something more horizontal where you're in conversation, as you've, I think, already alluded to, with many other aspects of this movement?
I'd definitely say the latter. I don't think, I think this movement, one of the things that is beautiful about the movement is in some senses, like a great organization, but lack of like a definitive leader, right? One person that everyone is just looking like to have all of the answers, right? Is that instead the movement has been built to empower the leadership of thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, right, of people. As you said, ordinary people, or as we might think, you know, beautiful and amazing people who are uniquely different, but together in struggle, to come together and to have their own voice, right? And to be empowered to be a leader on any given day, and to fall back and follow on any other day. And, you know, and for people to be able to pick up when others get tired, because this work is taxing. And so, yeah, I'll just repeat that we are really just part of that, and we are honored to be part of that and to be trusted by, you know, our the folks alongside us to lead the part of the work that we know how to do. And we follow the leadership of others in the work that they have the expertise and brilliance and passion for. And, you know, and hopefully that together, that's what leads to the change. Because I think, is it a top-down or a bottom-up sort of solution? You know, I think it's all of the above. I think the reality is that we need to come at this from every direction that we can, and using all of the strategies that are at our fingertips to see change. And so the reality is that the bottom-up public pressure, the power of the people, is by far the most impactful, because it moves the top to move. And so, yeah, I think that's, yeah, that's how I would, you know, really frame where we fit into what is a very powerful moment in history. And we're, you know, blessed and really thrilled to just be able to contribute what we can.
So for helping the mission of Worth Rises, what can Detroit Pistons players or NBA players specifically do to help you in your cause at this moment?
I'll start with the second one. I think when we think about players and even, you know, retired players who've built the Pistons brand, but players across the NBA, whether or not they're, you know, playing for the Pistons or not, what we're really hoping for is a voice at the table. I think the reality is that Tom, because of his position in not just society, but also with the NBA as an owner, can get the ear of players, other owners, and the league at any time. And the question is, you know, will all those parties, will the players, will the owners, will the league actually hear from, you know, those on the ground closest to the issue that are, you know, working on this issue. And so really, you know, want to make sure that all, you know, all we ask for is right now is a seat at the table to have those conversations and explain, frankly, that in almost everything we've read and everything we've seen, Tom is lying and misrepresenting the truth. We're not here to, you know, call names or do things like that, like Tom has done towards us. We just want to tell the truth, and the facts, I think, prove themselves. As for how, you know, folks in Detroit and across the country can support, please visit PistonsDeserveBetter.com. And there is a petition there that we ask that people sign, asking the NBA to force the sale of the Detroit Pistons unless Tom divests his assets from Securus and his interest in Securus entirely. And, you know, visit our site at worthrises.org. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at worthrises, where we post actions consistently. And there's a tremendous amount of information, more information about this campaign and, you know, about Tom and the harm he's causing communities and what you can do about it.
And then very briefly, I was really interested. You had Nicole Fleetwood, who I've interviewed as part of a curatorial team for an art exhibit called Capitalizing on Justice. I just wanted to ask if you had anything you could share about this exhibit and Dr. Fleetwood's collaboration with your organization.
Yeah, that was about, that was in 2018, so a few years ago now. Dr. Fleetwood is amazing. Love her. And it was such a privilege and honor to work alongside her in, you know, back in 2018. I have her book now on my coffee table. And I, you know, recommend anyone pick it up, Marking Time. And that art exhibit is actually available on our site. So if folks are interested in seeing the art, it was a really powerful exhibition called Capitalizing on Justice that featured the work of incarcerated artists from across the country, really responding to this question, this prompt around, you know, what the experience of capitalization through mass incarceration really is. And we got remarkable submissions from all over. I think there were 32 artists represented from probably close to just as many states in the exhibition, and covering issues from prison labor to prison healthcare, commissary, family visits, you sort of name it, the artist definitely touched on it. And it was a really beautiful exhibition that moved through a few different locations, but the digital exhibit is available on our site, and we encourage folks to take a look.
Well, in the words of Jesse Jackson, there's just rocks laying around. You're a David going against Goliaths, and I will be fighting with you in solidarity. Thank you so much for your time today, and it was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.